So hi, and welcome to Tea, Toast and Talking Birth. My name's Helen Jakes and I am this week's host. I've been a qualified nurse and midwife for numerous years now, and more recently I've moved into midwifery academia. So the hosts that are joining me this week are Frances Hodgson. Hi Frances.
Hello.
And we are also really, really delighted to welcome Sarah Chisholm, who's a student midwife who's just entered her third year of training at the University of Hull. Hello.
Hi.
Also contributing to this podcast is Leanne Watson. So Leanne has baby girl Myla, and she recently had an induction in February 2020, and we'll be hearing about her story later on. So this podcast aims to discuss and muse a different birth topic every week with the hosts, and some weeks we will be inviting special guests to contribute towards conversation. We don't intend any of our discussions to act as medical advice, and all of the considerations are merely our own thoughts and feelings on that particular subject this week, induction of labour, and we're utilising our collective experience and knowledge. Our aim is to bring together the wider community of birth, combining the clinical experience with the felt experience, hoping to demystify pregnancy and birth and share information. We do have social media accounts where any thoughts, comments or suggestions would really be welcome. And this is found on Instagram at Tea and Toast Talking Birth and at Twitter at birth_tea. So this week we'll be discussing the intervention of induction of labour. Induction is one of the most common interventions offered to pregnant women in the UK, with almost a third of all women reported to have their labours induced in 2018. There is wide variation in induction of labour rates between maternity units, however, although the number of inductions has risen by 60% in the last 10 years. The RCM in 2019 recognised that the women's experience of induction and labour can be shaped by lots of factors. These can include the method, the setting, the information and support received from healthcare providers, as well as the family and friends and woman's perceptions of risk, control and choice. For such a common intervention, we need to ensure women are informed and supported in making the decision to induce their labour, and to ensure that the experience of induction of labour is a positive one. Firstly, it seems really logical to discuss and ask the question, why would we induce a labour and how do we induce a labour? So, Frances, are you able to answer this for us?
Yes, I am. Though I'm going to have to try and not go into like lecturing mode here, because otherwise I'll be talking for 45 minutes without stopping. It can be quite a complex subject, so I'll try and keep it as to the point as possible. So induction of labour is when, instead of letting a pregnancy come to its natural conclusion and waiting for a woman to go into labour and give birth, medical professionals intervene in some way in order to prompt labour to start, rather than waiting, like I said, for it to happen on its own. And there's a host of different reasons why we might do this, but the common factor in all these reasons is that there is some kind of risk to either the mother or to the baby of the pregnancy continuing, and right. That is the rationale for offering induction of labour. The most common reason for offering induction of labour is pregnancies that continue beyond what we would consider the normal span of pregnancy. So that is normally pregnancies that continue beyond 42 weeks of pregnancy, though that will vary from area to area. Another reason might be for women whose waters have gone, but they haven't gone into labour. And then often they will be offered induction of labour, normally 24 to 48 hours after that has happened. There are lots of other reasons as well why we might be considering induction of labour for in particular cases. One of the interesting things is that what we find is that, as you've identified already, the rates of induction have really risen quite rapidly over the last few years. It ties in with our obstetric maternity culture of trying to reduce risk, which is obviously something that we want to do, and possibly with our increasing medicalisation of the ideas around birth and around pregnancy. I think one of the things that really needs looking at, and I don't think is being focused on a great deal yet, is while the rates of induction and indeed other kinds of interventions are going up quite significantly, we're not necessarily seeing the perinatal death rate, which is obviously what we're trying to, really the big focus is on reducing risk for babies, newborn babies, unborn babies. And we're not really seeing those rates falling as we might expect. And the rates are falling, but that seems to be more to do with improved care for very premature babies and things like that than it is to do with care in later pregnancy. So I think there's a lot more work to be done there to look at what exactly is going on and are we achieving what we're setting out to achieve. That to one side. There is definitely good research evidence. So there was a Cochrane review that came out in July of this year, which looked at induction of labour for post-AIDS pregnancy, which is what we call it when the pregnancies go beyond 41 or 42 weeks. And that that Cochrane review looked at all the available studies that are out there and drew conclusions based on that. And it does suggest that there is a small but significant decrease in the risk if we induce labour before a woman reaches a certain point. Right. The problem is, it's really quite vague about what that point is because the studies all had different points. So some studies started thinking about induction at 37 weeks. Others were looking at induction at 41 weeks. And what there isn't in there is a consensus about when in that 4-week range is the best point in terms of and safety.
Just to clarify for the listeners, Francis, why would we need to induce a labour if we think that it's gone over the 40 weeks or near the 40 weeks? What is the rationale for that?
Well, the rationale is based on this evidence that shows that there is an increased risk in stillbirth after 42 weeks. But what we don't actually know is the physiology behind that. There is a suggestion that the placenta might become less efficient over past that date. It may be something like that. Or there have been other suggestions that it's to do with because we think the babies are the ones that trigger labour, though we don't really understand how that mechanism works, that babies who are more compromised lack that ability to trigger the labour. But really, we don't necessarily understand the physiology behind it yet. But what we can say from the data is that that risk does increase. I think the really important thing to say at this point is that it increases, but the numbers we are talking about here are very, very small. So I don't want anyone listening to this to get terrified and think that it means that if you stay pregnant beyond your due date, that your baby is significantly at risk, because the numbers we're talking about here are extremely small. But what we can say is that the risk to the baby of either a stillbirth or a neonatal death, that risk does decrease if we induce labour. But like I say, there's a lot of debate about when in that spectrum is the appropriate time. And interestingly, which is kind of counterintuitive, this data also suggests that it might also reduce the rates of cesarean section if we induce labour. So what the studies tended to show, although again, it's not really definitive, but the suggestion is there, is that if we induce labour sometime in that period, those women are less likely to have a cesarean section than women who carry on being pregnant and go into labour on their own. So that's a really interesting point, and I think one that needs more exploration.
We often associate induction of labour with a more interventionist delivery. Mm. So actually, that does turn that around on its head. And actually, a lot of the advice that, you know, I've witnessed in practice is that we are giving people the advice that if they're having induction of labour, they are more likely to end up with a forceps cesarean, sort of something that's intervening. So it seems there is, you know, from that, what you've been saying, Francis, there is a lot of variation on thoughts and actual clinical evidence on induction to something that we're offering.
And like I say, a lot of it still needs further development, really, to pull it out. There's other interesting things as well about there's a developing kind of body of evidence. It's still in its infancy, but I think we'll see this coming through about longer term neurodevelopmental outcomes for children. And what that's suggesting is that for babies who've been induced, even at 39, 40 weeks, so not what we would consider premature, but premature for that child in the sense that they were born earlier than nature intended, that may have an impact on things like them meeting their developmental milestones later on. And like I say, the research around that is still quite in its early days yet, but there is some suggestion there that this is something we should be looking at, because obviously it's part of the bigger picture. And this is really the point with all of this, is to get the best possible information so that we can give that information to women and their families and they can make choices that are right for them. Yeah. And one of the things I find really worrying about the evidence base behind this is the lack of focus on women. There is very little in all of this evidence, there is very little interest shown in what women's opinions are, women's experiences are of induction of labour, which is true with evidence around an awful lot of things that we do. But it just, I really feel like in terms of the evidence in the future, in terms of future research, we should be talking to women much more about what they want and what is important to them and what information they want from us.
Absolutely.
Because only then can we go on and give them that information.
And you know, and a lot of the reasons, although we do induce for the women's health as well, a lot of the reasons is to reduce the risk to the newborn baby. And again, it comes down to the sort of consensus of discussion is to, you know, is the woman not important as this? When we're not looking at the woman's opinion and we're not looking and valuing and putting emphasis on how she feels about the process and also what information she's been given and how that was experienced by them, it kind of lessens the degree to which the woman had that control within their birth and giving birth in the induction process. So thank you, Frances. That's really great. Could you just embellish a little bit just for the listener on the types of induction that may be offered to women?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole different, the technical methods vary from area to area, depending on what trust you work, what guidelines they follow. The national guidelines, the NICE guidelines on this say particular things, but actually this is one of those areas where trusts tend to have their own specific guidelines that will vary from the national guidelines. So this is my little rider with this, that what you experience might well vary depending on where you are. The general point really of induction of labour is we're aiming to get your body to the point where it would be possible to break your waters, because that tends to set your labour off. Although the national guidelines say that that isn't how we should do it, and it's something completely different. But certainly the places I've had experience of working, the point is to try and get your cervix ripened and starting to get ready to labour in a way that then your waters can be broken. So I'll just talk through briefly how that might happen. So one of the things that women will be normally offered when they get to 40 weeks or 41 weeks, if you've had a baby previously, is something called a membrane sweep. And this is an internal examination normally done by your midwife. The idea of that is to stimulate your body's natural production of prostaglandins. So a membrane sweep isn't a method of induction as such, but it's something that's routinely offered because the evidence suggests that decreases the risk of you needing formal induction later on. So you're more likely for your body to go into labour if you've had a membrane sweep. It doesn't work for everyone. It's more effective if your body's already kind of gearing up, and then it might speed things up a little bit. If we left you alone, you wouldn't have a baby for another 2 weeks, then a membrane sweep probably isn't going to have a significant impact on what's going to happen next. So that can be offered, and some women will have more than one membrane sweep, so they can be offered repeatedly, say 48 hours apart, or they might be offered weekly. It just depends on what your particular circumstances and about where you are. Another thing that might happen is the use of prostaglandins, and that is a synthetic version of your body's own natural prostaglandins. And the idea of that is that this is what softens the cervix. It starts the tissues start to break down a little bit and get ready for that opening of the cervix that happens in labour. Sometimes prostaglandins on their own can stimulate labour, and sometimes they can just move things forward to the point where, say, you might be able to have your waters broken. Normally, prostaglandins would be done as an inpatient procedure. So you would go into the hospital, you'd be on an antenatal ward, something like that. And it can be done there's slightly different technical methods about how the prostaglandins are delivered that will vary depending, again, on what trust you're in. But normally it's a process that takes days rather than hours. So it can be quite a slow process. And like I say, sometimes that will be enough to get you into labour, and sometimes that won't. Another thing that is something with increasing interest over the last few years is the use of mechanical induction of labour. So that is things like a balloon catheter. And there was a Cochrane review looking at that quite recently, which suggests balloon catheters have similar outcomes to the use of prostaglandins. But some women prefer the balloon catheters because they can be done often as an outpatient. So you might have this done and then you can go home and wait at home. And also there's slightly less risk of the baby having irregular heart rate patterns because it's not a medication. So the balloon catheter is what it says, really. It's a very small balloon that is inserted before it's inflated, obviously, is inserted through the cervix and then inflated with some sterile water. And that sits in place for normally 24 hours. And the mechanical action of the weight of the water presses against the cervix and encourages it to open up. And so it much the same way as a membrane sweep works, really. And so some trusts are starting to use balloon catheters instead of prostaglandins, or they might use balloon catheters first and then move on to prostaglandins. And then obviously, then the final things to talk about really in the process would be the process of having your waters broken, which we've already mentioned. Like I say, the national guidelines don't actually support that as a method of induction, but many trusts will use that. So once your cervix is ripened enough that it's possible for a midwife or a doctor to examine you internally and break your waters, then that would happen. And then after that, it may be that your body goes into labour on its own, or it may be that then they'll suggest the use of a hormone drip, which would trigger your body to start contractions as it would when you were in labour, but obviously in an artificial way, because it's not your natural hormone, it's an artificial hormone. Do you want to add anything, Helen or Sarah?
No, I think you've described the processes really well, and really it is almost like a sliding scale as to how your cervix is responding to the methods that we are offering and doing.
Yeah, and I think that's really important to note that the whole of this process can be fairly quick and fairly easy, or it can be very long and drawn out over a period of days, yeah, sometimes even weeks. And a lot of that will depend on how ready your body is to labour, because if your body isn't ready, you know, we're working against nature then. We're working against what your body naturally wants to do, and that makes it harder.
I really like the, is it the Mary Cronk quote, where she said that with the sort of the balance of labour hormones and muscles doing work and everything, to induce labour is like throwing one synchronised swimmer into the pool and hoping that the rest jump in. So that's why it can take quite a while.
That's a brilliant. Great quote.
And obviously, yeah, they sometimes are poised on the side ready to dive, but yeah, after that, sometimes they're not always.
Eating the lunch. So yeah, and I think I would really reinforce that, in that sometimes the women, like you say, and we can never tell what stage that woman is going to be at when we assess them and check how ready they are for a certain point of the induction process, and also how their bodies will respond, because again, it's a blanket approach. We're giving certain hormones and treating everybody the same, whereas actually everyone's slightly individual. All our cervixes are different, all our cervixes will open at different times, so we have to judge that at the time. And that's why sometimes it can happen really quick and sometimes it can't, and that's sometimes why the advice that we give women can be very difficult as well, because yes, we might be telling you, well, actually it could take 3 days to get you in labor, and then someone comes in and within one membrane sweep they've gone into labor and had their baby, you know. So it is so varied and drawn out and can be quite long at times. We know that induction of labour can be a different experience for so many different women. However, it's really, really important that the woman's voice is heard. And we're incredibly grateful to have Leanne with us, who's agreed to tell us her story. So, Leanne, first of all, could you just tell us about your experience of induction of labour?
Yeah, of course. So prior to me actually going into the hospital to have my little girl, I was terrified at the thought of being induced. I don't know how I'd got it into my head, but I had this complete misconception that it was going to be the worst thing ever. Yeah. I think when you're pregnant, you spend all that time towards the like later stages of your pregnancy, you're Googling and joining your mum groups and everything. And I'd read some stories that weren't particularly positive.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine had been induced, and as other mums do, they like to give you the horror story and tell you the worst case scenario. But actually, I wouldn't change anything about my labour. I thought, despite the fact that I was induced and despite the fact that I felt like I went through every induction process I possibly could, it was absolutely fine. It was long and it was tiring, but it wasn't the negative experience I thought it was going to be.
So what happened to you? What's your induction story?
So I had a really, really bad headache one evening, and I'd been going to the children's centres for regular blood pressure checks because there was preeclampsia in the family. So I rang the ward begrudgingly. I will say I didn't want to go in. So I rang the ward and they said come in. So they checked my blood pressure for me, and the lady that did it said, you know, that's not okay. We're gonna have to keep you overnight for monitoring. And then the next day, they basically said there was no change in my blood pressure and that I needed to be induced. So I had a examination done, and the lady that did it said that my cervix was not dilated at all, and I think it was facing backwards. So that obviously just initially just terrified me because I thought, oh God, what on earth are they going to do to me now? But I had a sweep and nothing happened. And because they needed to induce me, they did say that a pessary probably wouldn't work. They said, I think the phrasing was my cervix wasn't very favourable.
That's a common word we use, yeah.
So they decided that the best thing to do would be to start off with something that my interpretation was that it was a bit gentler, and they fitted me with a balloon. So that was the first thing I had done. And again, like somebody tells you that they're going to put a balloon inside you, you think, oh,
Yeah, you think of a
no.
party balloon, don't you?
But you know, like the midwives, and also I was under a consultant and he was fab. Like he stayed and he fitted it for me. They explained exactly what it was going to do, how it was going to be fitted, what it would feel like while it was in there, how I could tell that it was doing its job, sort of thing. And yeah, they were super. And they one thing I really did like is that the midwife did say to me, if at any point, you know, you feel like you can't bear it anymore, we'll just take it out for you. So I felt really reassured by that as well, because it's one of them things. Like I said to my husband, like, oh God, what if I put this thing in and it don't work, and you know, I'm being a bit of a wimp. But they were so reassuring, like they were really good. So they told me that for it to work, sort of thing, they usually keep it in, I think it was 24 hours. So I managed the 24 hours, but it didn't really do an awful lot.
Was you an inpatient while you had that, Leanne? Was you in the hospital?
I was, yeah. So I actually went into hospital on the Tuesday night, and I didn't come out till the following Tuesday after I'd had Mila. So after the balloon didn't work, I think my cervix had dilated ever so slightly, and I don't remember how many I had, but I had quite a few sweeps. And again, like when I think I just built up this really negative image of what was going to happen to me, because every time someone was like, right, we're going to do this to you, I thought, oh. But actually, the midwives were just fab. Like, you know, it's daunting, isn't it? Thinking that you're gonna have your legs up in the air, or you know, for all to see, for people that you don't know as well. But I've never, like, I was just sat there having a chat. Like, they're just so like respectful, and you don't think anything of it. Like, it just didn't bother me at all, which is really weird for me to say.
What's really good about that is that you've already said like you had really negative connotations going in there and that you felt daunted by it all, but actually when the actual reality of it happened, it wasn't anything like what you imagined it was going to be at all.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely not. I just the whole process, it was just a lot more positive than I anticipated. Because you hear everybody saying, oh, I went through this and I went through that, but then when you are actually going through it, it's you just go through the motions, and you've got such a good support network. You just didn't, and at the end of the day, you get your baby at the end, don't you? So you do it all over again in the blink of an eye.
So what happened? So you've had a few sweeps, you've had the balloon, it's not worked, you're still in hospital. What happened next?
So I had a pessary fitted. It didn't do an awful lot, so they had to wait a little while before I had my next one. And I think I ended up, I think it was three I had in the end. It's a little bit blurry, I won't lie. And by the third one of the midwives came in, and she was obviously nice, and she said, look, everything I've touched today has gone into labour. So So let's hope the same for you. So she gave me a sweep, and I did start to get some more tightenings. This was on the Friday at this point. By the Friday night, I was in a lot of pain. I know I probably wasn't in, I don't know the different terminology. I don't know whether it was active labour or what, but the tightenings were coming more and more. So I spent a lot of Friday night in the bath. So yeah, that was the Friday night. By the Saturday morning, I'm sure you can imagine I was absolutely exhausted. And a lady came in and said, we're going to try and break your water for you. We'll have to see if you're dilated enough. And I think the impression I got was that if I wasn't able to have my waters broken, then I was probably going to have to go in for a cesarean.
Right.
Just because it had been going on for, yeah. I don't know whether it's classed as a long time. It felt like a long time.
Yeah.
Luckily, she managed to do it. And again, a friend of mine had said she'd had her waters broken, and she looked and she saw this huge hook, and it was this and it was that. And I thought, the minute I heard someone go, I'm going to have to break your waters for you, I thought, oh no. I said to Steve, I said, I can't do it. I said, well, he was like, you've got no choice, we've got to. And the lady that did it was so good. She spoke through it with me. She, you know, even though I was very worse for wear, I was very tired. I remember it being done, and I remember feeling my waters and saying, is that it? Is it done already?
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah, that's sorted. So then the final bit that I had after I'd had that, my water's broken, is my midwife Vicky said, you know, it's been a long time now, Leanne, and you're absolutely tired out. I think we're going to just speed things up a bit now, just to get us through that final bit. And that put me on, I can't remember what the name is, the drip.
Yep, the hormone on drip, yeah.
Yeah. And I had heard that the drip can make you, your pains feel, you know, this, that and the other. So at this point, I have to say, I was absolutely exhausted and I had an epidural. And because I'd had the epidural, I actually fell to sleep, which was glorious. Yeah. Because by the time I woke up, my midwife, Vicky, did an examination and I was fully dilated, because the drip had just sent everything from 0 to 100.
Yeah.
And I remember her saying, you're fully, and me thinking, yay, it's time. And despite the fact that I was so tired, I pushed Mila out in 40 minutes, which I thought was...
And that's an amazing example. I mean, your whole story, you're absolutely right. You've had every part of the process that you can possibly have from the very start to the end. So it's a great example of how it, you know, different labours turn out differently, and actually sometimes everything's got a place.
Yeah, definitely. I think one thing I've learned, and I said to Steve, is if we were to go on to have another, I would literally go in there with no sort of idea of what I was wanting to do, not wanting to do.
Can you just tell us, and I think you've sort of said this really, but you felt really informed as to why they suggested that you needed induction at the first point. You felt that they identified the rationale and they told you why they wanted to induce you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so when I did go in initially on that Tuesday evening, the girl that saw me, I don't know whether she was actually a student midwife, and I don't mean this in any way, shape or form rude, but even as a student, she was really informative. Like, she was able to sit and say to me, like, your blood pressure's too high. Yeah. I can't obviously remember the full conversation because it was 8 months ago, but she took the time to explain to me about the risks of preeclampsia, and with it running in the family, you know, the problems that it can cause and why they need to look at inducing me to sort of speed things along. Yeah. And then what I thought was really nice as well is a consultant did exactly the same. Like, he was happy to also sit and have this conversation. I just thought every stage of what we went through, everyone took the time to explain what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think having the consultant sit there and explain to me what it's going to do, how it's going to work, like, you know, reassuring me that it can be taken out if necessary, you know, and actually saying, is it, you know, do you agree to it, sort of thing, is it all right if we do it? I just thought it was a big thing.
Leanne, thank you so much for sharing your story. It is a really wonderful tale that you've got to tell, and I'm so glad that you had such an empowering birth and that you felt, you know, really in control at all the stages through something that sort of, in a medical terms, we were taken away from you and doing things to you, yeah, but actually you still felt empowered. So yeah, a really great story to share with our listeners. Okay, so that's great. So Sarah, what was your experience in practice? So you've been in practice as a second year student and you've been on labour ward, and thank you so much for coming to put your contribution into this, because as a student, I'm really conscious that you have a lot of experience and knowledge with induction, because you're often there for long periods of time during your placement, so you often see the long process that can sometimes be induction of labour. So if you can tell us sort of collectively what your experience has been of induction of labour in practice.
Okay, thanks Helen. So we induce around a third of pregnancies in my local trust. So I participated in the induction process on the antenatal ward in one placement, and then later on in the process on labour ward more recently. So I've been looking after women who are having an induction for a lot of different indications. So some of them, it might be because they have diabetes, because their pregnancy is post-dates, because they've had a lot of reduced fetal movements, or that their baby's measured small for dates. So particularly I was thinking, I had a little reflection on what I've seen, and I've noticed that there was women who've had a low risk pregnancy and they were anticipating birthing on the midwifery led unit can sometimes find it quite a big change to be told that they've been recommended an induction for whatever reason, and then to kind of transition their expectations from what they had originally anticipated to their new sort of care situation. So I particularly looked after one woman recently she was prepared to hypnobirth. She was really excited. And she said to me, oh, it's all gone out the window, I'll just have all the drugs now. And I thought that was really sad, because she wasn't at the position where she was requesting pain relief yet. So it wasn't that she was needing drugs for pain relief. She'd sort of given up on her preferences for labour and birth. And I think that means it's really important then that we tease their birth preferences and labour preferences out of women quite early on, and reassure them that it doesn't necessarily mean that everything was pointless. I reassured her that, you know, hypnobirthing can be really valuable in the situation of any birth experience, whether you're in theatre, whether you're having an induction. It's that mindset that's really helpful and valuable.
Absolutely. I really agree with that, because I feel that one of the problems that we have at the moment in the way we deliver our maternity care is that there's this huge dichotomy, like a divide in the middle between low risk care and high risk care, and no crossover at all. And I really feel that that place in the middle is the place where we've got so much work to do about how can we use aspects of what we would consider to be low risk midwifery led type care in women whose situations have got more complicated than that, and they've got things going on in the background. How can we bring over those things that are, like you say, really important to them, and will make their experience what they wanted, and empowering, like Leanne was saying, but in a more medicalized setting than they had maybe been anticipating?
Exactly. It's an excellent point, and I come across this quite a lot in the practice of yoga that I do as well. And I see women that get so upset if their birth doesn't go as they planned it, because they ended up being induced. And like you say, they kind of almost give up on that hopeful of this natural, normal birth that they think they might have. And actually, it's about the mindset, and it's about knowing that with an induction, yes, we're intervening, we're doing something, but at the same time, it's still your birth, and whatever the outcome of that, it's having control over the decisions that you make within that birth. Excellent point.
Yeah, I also noticed that I think because her partner had sort of, it was their first pregnancy together, and he seemed to have mentally prepared himself for quite a different experience. And as soon as it became quite medicalized, he very much sat by the wall and said, I'll just stay out of your way. We were thinking, well, you know, there's no need for you to stay out of our way. We're just carrying out a routine processes. This isn't a medical emergency. You need to be with your partner and sitting close to her and providing that support. If that's what you were planning on doing, don't change that for us. Don't be thinking that you need to tiptoe around us.
The choice, the balance of power shifted, because we were doing something to them, and it becomes slightly medicalized, that they felt that it was out of their hands and out of their control, and that we were in control. Do you feel that that's a common scenario?
It was so perfectly depicted by what I saw in front of me. I was thinking, oh, this is such a shame that they feel that this is not their space. So I very much sort of tried to encourage them to dim the lighting as and when they wanted. They talked about listening to some music during labour, and I think they thought that wasn't an option. But it turned out, luckily, they'd been antenatally quite well prepared, and they brought a speaker, so we got some music on and tried to sort of make the space a bit more familiar for them and introduce a bit more what they were expecting to the care.
And actually, it almost comes to a point where it becomes not more important, because it's never more important, but it's almost... You want to keep hold of those things that you can keep hold of when we're intervening with the birth, to make sure that you still feel like you are in control.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. That goes back to our first podcast when we were talking about a positive birth experience, doesn't it? And one of the things that came across so strongly in the evidence and the things we looked at, that women's feeling of control. And that's this thing, is that if things aren't going how you'd planned, it's, do you throw your hands up and relinquish all control to the medical professionals and just let them get on with it? Or do we work together to try and find areas where women can still feel in control of their environment, of their experience, and of what goes on around them, even if it wasn't what they had originally planned?
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, Sarah, are you going to say something else before I interrupt her?
I was only going to say, I think people's experiences of induction have also changed a little bit, because if they've had that time, that extended period of time on the antenatal ward, in the COVID situation, they've not had a birth partner able to visit them or to spend a lot of time there. So I think they're coming up to the labour ward quite upset already by this. They've been quite isolated. And I think particularly a lot of the women that I've looked after have just been really relieved to get their birth partner there with them as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a time when people can feel a bit more supported by their birth partners. And maybe, I don't know, but there's no sort of easy solution to that, is there? It's the COVID crisis, and yeah, it's having this negative impact on women who are having inductions. Fortunately, that won't have affected Leanne.
No, definitely not. Do you think that in your experience then, that women are generally well informed about the reasons for the induction of labour and the process of induction of labour?
So I think in my experience, we are a lot better at informing them about the process than about having a really individualised, rich antenatal discussion about the risks and the alternatives, as well as the benefits of induction of labour. But I think as midwives, we don't really get that time built into the schedule. So from what I've seen when I've worked in community, you don't get a longer appointment to discuss the induction process and the options. So you're very much sort of trying to fit that into all of the care that you're carrying out in that antenatal appointment. I mean, women do then get referred to an obstetric clinic, so they're going to have that conversation with an obstetrician. But I don't think, as far as I can work out in our trust, that they're going to have that what are my options and what are my alternatives conversation with a midwife, unless the midwife is proactively sort of blocked out a bit of time to do that with them.
I think that's a very good point. Sorry to interrupt, Sarah.
I was going to say, they get a leaflet, but I don't think that's...
No. And in some trusts, they have adopted, because as we know, as Frances has already said, post-maturity of the fetus is one of the reasons that we often induce people. And in some trusts, they have adopted a sort of overdates clinic where the women will come and they'll have time with the midwife, they'll discuss, they'll be able to talk about sort of more holistic methods of relaxing, because it's more likely to get the hormones to come that will start the labour off. And actually, maybe that's a way that we need to start looking at induction of labour, if there's not sort of a medical reason that we're doing it, if it's for more post-maturity, is that we spend that time with the women and reassure them and offer them alternative methods to try before we go down the medical route, and reassure women as well that if they do end up with an induction, it doesn't have to be a negative process that they have, and they can still have the birth that they desire and hope for as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. There are nationwide some really like forward thinking trusts who are doing some amazing stuff with pre-induction clinics, or where they might be offering things like acupuncture, acupressure, aromatherapy services. And like you say, and there is some research evidence to support the use of alternative therapies in terms of inducing labor, though, you know, again, as with most of the alternative therapies, the volume and the quantity of evidence isn't always there. But like you've rightly pointed out, women go into labour most easily and best when the hormonal setting is right within their bodies, when they're feeling relaxed, when they're feeling ready to labour. So I think it's got a really valuable role to play in that, from the impact that the psychology has on the physiology of the body.
And I think, like you've said, Sarah, that they tend to go to a more obstetric if we're looking at induction. But actually, there probably is a role for midwives within that process that is being missed, because we're not given the time for the midwives to have those discussions with the women and the families in any great depth. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends. It's one of those unfortunate situations as well, whereas if you're in a continuity of care team, you might find that a midwife is able to arrange her appointments that she knows she's going to want to spend a bit more time having that discussion. But unfortunately, that's not rolled out across all areas in our trust yet. So it's sort of dependent on whether yeah. you've been lucky enough to manage to get a continuity of care team caring for you. But I have had a placement with a continuity of care team, and I do know that they deliberately schedule longer appointments when they know that they have a good discussion to be had. And I don't think that women are always aware of how much of a choice there is, and that there are the alternatives. I know that women, you know, they do know that they can decline an induction, and that there is an expectant management process that would then be followed with additional monitoring. But I don't know how many women feel that they can reject that because it's been offered. And I think women are very much keen to, if it's been offered by a doctor, then perhaps that is the route that they should take, rather than sort of critiquing the evidence and feeling confident in being able to consider the evidence from all sides.
And again, it works back to sort of, I think everything always goes back to our first podcast, but it works back to a society of fear culture, doesn't it? And actually risk taking, and are we offering valuable alternatives? And if the evidence isn't pointing towards that, you know, it is something valuable and we haven't got that much robust evidence, then are we offering and letting people have full informed choice? A debatable argument, really, and it's one that we should probably take into more consideration, particularly because the rates are rising.
Yeah.
And I think it comes back to the point that's always really difficult in communications, which is about our power balance, isn't it? It's about however much we think we're approachable and it's a non-hierarchical system and we're working in partnership with women and their families, there is still this perception that what we as midwives and obstetricians say is like, we know everything, and if we give someone information, then that is obviously right, and it's right for that particular woman. And all of these discussions that we have, I think, in the podcasts come back to how do we do more individualized care, more partnership working with the women, where their voices are just as important as ours and their wishes and their opinions are just as important as anything we can tell them. You know, as long as we can give them the information, then they can consider that and make their own choices.
Would you agree, Sarah, that sort of the advice and the discussion that you've seen with women is very generalised in terms of induction?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think I've seen women who have been induced for reasons where, you know, the baby was likely to have become compromised quite quickly if it had been left for a long time to go into labour spontaneously. But it's sort of the blanket information that's then given to women who are perhaps... I think there's quite a lot of work to be done to make sure that women are aware of their individual risks and options rather than just the blanket sort of group of options. And I mean, when I was having a good read around induction to write a bit of a reflective about the inductions that I've seen, and you get some alarming fear factors, don't you? Like, I read an article that was called The Dead Baby Card, and it's about, you know, when it was generally around the world, but obstetricians pulled the dead baby card to say, you know, this is why you should have an induction.
Yeah.
It can be really, it's really horrible. It's really,
and you know, coercive. Given a choice when you're pregnant and someone pulls that out, then actually it's not really given any choice, is it? Because nobody's going to choose that option, are they?
Whereas if you laid out statistics and then said, but actually, you know, there's been very little research done in terms of women's experiences, but your psychological experience, your outcome will live with you forever.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you've experienced, you tell anyone you're a midwife or you're studying midwifery and they'll tell you about their birth because it stayed with them for years.
Yeah.
And so actually when women weigh up the individualized statistic for them versus what, you know, what they could feel about this birth forever, and the fact that women often do report less satisfaction with induction.
Yeah.
They might make choices different to what they would make if they thought it was quite a black and white decision.
Yeah, I think that sort of hits the nail on the head, doesn't it? We've sort of already said that, where it feels out of their hands when we're taking that away from them. And actually, when we look at the rationale as to why we're doing it, we may not actually be giving them the full evidence as to why we are suggesting that we offer that.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, we talk a lot about informed consent in our job, and that is absolutely what we should be aiming for. Informed consent is not the same as somebody agreeing to something because you've told them that their baby might die if they don't do it. It's never informed consent if people are afraid not to consent. And yes, we have to be realistic about, you know, and we have to say that this is the evidence as we know it at the moment, and that these are the risks, and these are the other things to consider. But it should be done in a way that is not emotive, a way that is not inducing fear, because again, apart from anything else, it's going to inhibit women's ability to labor if we're sending their adrenaline levels through the roof by talking to them about all these horrible things that could go wrong. It's going to really have an impact on the likelihood of them going into labor spontaneously anyway. So it's as much about how we deliver the information as it is about what information we deliver. I think
absolutely. And I think, sort of to summary, because I know we're kind of getting to the end of the podcast, I think for me, induction of labour seems to be something that has risen in popularity, risen as a method of resolving situations, but we've taken little account as to the complexities of the women involved and the families involved in the induction process on the way. And I think we need to catch up. I think we're offering it as a form of resolution, but actually we haven't caught up in terms of, is this actually best for everybody that's involved? Anyone else want to summarise?
No, I think that's a really good summary of what's going on, really, isn't it? It's that consideration of the holistic thing, that it's got to be about the whole picture and everything that's going on around. And yes, in many cases, many women will want induction of labour, and in many cases we'll give them the information and they'll go, yes, I'm choosing this because I believe this will be best for my family. And that's brilliant. It's fantastic that we live in an age where we have these resources available and we can save women's lives and we can save babies' lives. But we should also be leaving the spaces there for women to have that individualized care that works for them, that says, actually, do you know what? I've looked at the research, I've looked at the evidence. I feel that for me, for my baby, for my family, this isn't right at the moment. And we should support them in that, obviously, as we do with everything else, and say, right, okay, well, we'll make a plan that works for you.
That's absolutely fab. And I feel like we've only just scratched the surface, really, of induction of labour. And I think that actually it might be worthwhile to have another podcast at a later date to discuss it even further in depth, because there is such a wide scope of opinion to discuss on induction. Sarah, thank you so much for your valuable contribution. That was absolutely amazing. And thank you, Leanne, for your experience. And I'm so pleased it was such a positive one and you felt empowered in the end. Francis, as ever, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast. If you have any suggestions or any discussion or any opinions on anything that we've discussed, we would always love to hear from you. So you can contact us via social media. We'd really, really like to hear from you. And yeah, I think we'll have to talk about it again. Thank you very much.